30 years ago, South Africa adopted one of the most admired constitutions in the democratic world, which opens with this preamble. We, the people of South Africa, recognize the injustices of our past, honor those who suffered for justice and freedom in our land, respect those who have worked to build and develop our country, and believe that South Africa belongs to all who live in it, united in our diversity. We, therefore, through our freely elected representatives, adopt this constitution as the supreme law of the republic, so as to heal the divisions of the past and establish a society based on democratic values, social justice, and fundamental human rights. Lay the foundation for a democratic and open society in which government is based on the will of the people and every citizen is equally protected by law. Improve the quality of life of all citizens and free the potential of each person, and build a united and democratic South Africa able to take its rightful place as a sovereign state in the family of nations. May God protect our people. Because those words still feel incredibly ambitious. We're 30 years into a constitutional democracy that I keep thinking about the gap between what was promised and what people feel. So I've asked my friend Nicole Fritz, a lawyer, to come and chat with me because she understands and works in the place where legal principle, democratic accountability, civil liberties, constitutional culture, institutional critique clash into each other every day. You know, Nicole, one of the things, so in my worry about how this conversation can flow, the thing that I'm hoping we are able to do is have a conversation that's both a philosophical conversation about this amazing constitution that we have and the gap in the reality. So sure. the promise versus what people are experiencing. Exactly. Because I think that that's one of the biggest things that a lot of South Africans are grappling with today.
Yeah.
Is there was so much excitement, so much hope when this constitution was presented to the people, when it was signed off and eventually became this living document that it is. But a lot of the pieces of the constitution, with the corruption, with the poverty, with the hardships of the economy that people are experiencing, people are asking themselves, is this thing really worth it?
Yeah. Although, I mean, again, I think we're having some really irresponsible political leadership that are asking them to sort of attack a piece of paper rather than, you know, absolutely it hasn't delivered on the promises. But where is it in the Constitution that is the cause of the hardship? It's rather that we're not using it as the tool that it was always intended to be, right? It's not been fully actuated.
And when you live in a world that both understands intimately as a lawyer what the Constitution is and work within a sector that to a large extent is about holding up these constitutional promises and as a guardrail to the power structures.
Exactly.
And do you think that the Constitution in that way has delivered for the people of South Africa in the way that it's protected us from reckless leadership?
I do think so, right? And I mean, I think often we've asked of the Constitutional Court, which is, you know, in terms of the Constitution, the ultimate referee, we've asked it to take on, you know, hugely kind of burdensome, onerous obligations in that ultimately what the Constitution is about sort of limiting power, about checking power in the name of the people. And, you know, the people in all their, you know, kind of diversity and variety, but saying there are limits to the way in which this power is exercised on the part of the people. And we've seen the Constitution. I mean, I can't think back on that image of Justice Kampepe all alone in the courtroom, you know, handing down judgment in respect of former President Jacob Zuma, finding him to have acted in contempt of court and sentencing him to a prison term for that disrespect of the Constitution. And so the court has really been asked to, you know, acting for the Constitution has been asked to act in ways that really require it to take on an enormous burden, right?
Well, you talk about the court, and every time we hear all of these judgments and we're taking it to the Constitutional Court right now, I'm thinking in particular about Nandipha Magutumane and the fact that she's gone to the Constitutional Court to say, listen, my constitutional rights have been... And I'm interested in your understanding of what some of these rights, because often they will say my rights have been violated, and no one really names what those rights are.
Right.
So we don't hear it. So yeah. I'm trying to think, what is Nandipha's case?
Okay.
Her in particular, but generally too, you know, when judgments have gone all the way up to the Constitutional Court, how the framing of those rights, do you think enough South Africans understand what their rights are?
No. I mean, and again, I think that that's what's allowing, you know, I think some irresponsible political leaders to say, you know, to the extent that too many South Africans are still living these lives of desperation, of kind of unbelievable hardship and poverty. And for political leaders to you know, say, you know, we haven't delivered, but that's not really our fault. It's, you know, the Constitution. The Constitution is holding us back. And the fact is that they can sell people this nonsense story, because actually I don't think people are aware enough of what is contained in the Constitution. So there are very specific rights, and we talk, I mean, as lawyers, we talk about first-generation rights, by which we mean civil and political rights, and their rights to freedom of association, freedom of expression, freedom of bodily autonomy and security. But then we also talk about these second and third generation rights, which are socioeconomic rights. And the Constitution was really groundbreaking, and in many ways is still groundbreaking, for the fact that it doesn't only include, you know, rights to fair trial, and it details what those rights to fair trial are, but it also gives you rights to access to housing, rights to access to food, to education. Those rights are worded differently from your typical rights to, you know, fair trial rights. And it means that we, the courts, interpret them differently, but they are no less kind of enforceable and have a bearing. And so, yes, as I say, I think what we have, I mean, particularly for younger generations potentially, is not enough awareness of what is in this document. But, you know, what I think is also important to realize is that, you know, Justice Chaskalson, who was the Chief Justice of South Africa, famously said, you know, that the rights contained in our Constitution are, you know, therefore, obviously, not only the powerful, right? They check the powerful and their ability to exercise power, but they also have rights. But those rights contained there are therefore the most vulnerable amongst us, and also for the least favorable, right? So even those that we think are, you know, facing criminal prosecution, and rightly facing criminal prosecution and accountability, should be able to access the rights contained in this document.
And I think when reading the judgment with the banning, I think that's the one that you're referring to, of the of capital punishment, right?
Yes.
The weakest and the worst.
Yes.
That the Constitution
weakest and the worst amongst us.
Is
yes.
Also to protect the weakest and the worst amongst us.
Exactly.
And with you talk about political leaders and some of the irresponsible utterances. We know, everybody keeps telling us that this we have possibly the high end, most souped up Porsche of constitutions, right?
Yeah.
And yet there is plenty of talk that says the Constitution needs to be changed. It needs to be changed here, it needs to be changed here. These things aren't working, this isn't working, therefore we must change the Constitution. And I'm wondering if that is a failure, maybe, of the political system and the politicians to actively do what is right or play the game as it has been set out, and therefore they want to change the rules.
I mean, my sense is that I think you're right. You have somebody like, I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was famous female judge on the American Supreme Court. And she famously said and earned a lot of detractors in the United States because during the Arab Spring and when there was this chance of reform, she was approached by activists in Egypt who were saying, you know, what do we look to in terms of, you know, ushering in a constitutional democracy? And she said, well, if I were you, I wouldn't look to the United States and its constitution. I would look to the South African constitution. And of course, that, as I said, was met with some controversy in the United States, the sense that she wasn't selling up their own document, but, you know, directed attention to South Africa. It is, as you say, I mean, even 30 years old, still incredibly progressive in terms of its of what it inscribes, of what it protects, but also its vision for a constitutional democracy. And that sense, right? I mean, it was true 30 years ago. It's true still now. Not requiring us to be the same. So when it protects equality and dignity and, you know, prohibits discrimination, it's not on this idea that we should all sort of emulate some same model, but is requiring or orchestrating this unity on the basis of rules of fairness, that no matter our sort of diversity and differences, that those fundamental rules of fairness allow us all to live together. And so, as I say, yes, there has been some talk of amending the Constitution. I think, you know, most famously in respect of Section 27, which is protection of rights to property, a suggestion that we would have had more expansive land reform or transformation with that provision holding us back. Again, I think that that is a misstatement and that ultimately the Constitution gives the potential and the fact is that that potential has not been realized. Mm. But it is irresponsible political actors who are looking for scapegoats to explain why there hasn't been delivery as we rightly have wanted and that this Constitution allows. And they're saying it's not our terrible governance. It is this piece of paper.
Well, you know, the fact that our mastheads united in our diversity, the idea that diversity and the recognition that South Africans are so different from each other, different faiths, different cultures, yeah, different traditions. And yet here is a document that can hold us all, exactly, as it were,
yeah,
fairly and appropriately within the construct of a shared space. In a world today where there is a cancel culture, right? And we have seen a rise, a big rise, not just here at home, all over the world, right, but here at home in particular, of wanting to silence or stop people from believing particular things or wanting to adhere to a different thought process. How does that sit comfortably with this reality, you know, that the Constitution says all of us are free to associate with whom we want to associate with, are free to hold our particular beliefs as long as they do not hurt or take away the beliefs of other people? And yet we see a lot of that beginning to creep in the way that people protest, in the way that people, I mean, I just think about the shutdowns, right, in the cities, in Durban, in Johannesburg, we've been seeing lately with migrants. All of that with the Constitution that we have.
No, exactly. And I think that, you know, you've spoken about the right to association, freedom of opinion. You know, I'm based at the Campaign for Free Expression, and it is very much about trying to give life and meaning to the central right about the fact that we all have the right to express ourselves, an equal right to express ourselves. And so to the extent that there is a kind of cancel culture that looks to limit and shut down those associative rights, one's right to speech. Those are trends that negate our Constitution. And again, I think to bring it back to, you know, 30 years of celebration, I think, you know, the Constitution can't be divorced from the Constitutional Court and the ultimate institution which gives its life. And you think about those first 11 judges who take up the seats on the Constitutional Court And I mean, you've referenced Ace versus Makwanyana, the first judgment, which was around the death penalty. But you think about those 11 individuals and who they represented, right? And you've got judges from the old order. I mean, they were enlightened judgments, judges, and often judges who within the system had tried to oppose apartheid. But they had been serving judges. And then you have sort of former activists of the type of Albie Sachs.
Moseneke,
and he rises to the position of Deputy Chief Justice, having spent all that time on Robben Island. You have these two young women who come in, right? Justice Yvonne Mokgoro and Justice Kate O'Regan. And I mean, they're two of the 11, but at a time when we had not had women on the judiciary, mm-hmm. right? And they become mm-hmm. so central to
and
the
Justice
jurisprudence.
Cameron and is openly.
Exactly. Who's openly HIV positive and, you know, sort of an openly gay jurist. Exactly. And they give real meaning to what it means to live in this country mm-hmm. that is premised on this idea that we celebrate difference and diversity. We're not trying to create the sameness. We're just creating fairness mm-hmm. so that we all in our difference can have those rights.
Can be.
Exactly.
And, you know, when you talk about even just the diversity of the people in the court themselves, I also then think about, and at the beginning, the Constitutional Court was constitutional matters, but it's shifted slightly over the years yes. and it's now become a court of last review. And often I see things going to the Constitutional Court and I'm asking myself, is this a constitutional matter though? You know, is this constitutional? Should they be taking this on? And some of those, again, I will bring up the Nandipha Makudumane, yeah. are like big, flashy cases. Has the court fallen into the trap of the flash of what media wants and what popular culture is expecting to hear them pronounce on?
Look, I mean, I do think because the constitutional, it has to some extent, again, asked a lot of the Constitutional Court because there has been this expansion of its mandate, as it were. But given that the Constitution is the framework within which we understand and interpret all our other laws, it's not wrong to think that every case, in a sense, has a constitutional dimension when that is the supporting framework. I think the Constitutional Court is pretty good about policing its docket. And so basically, I mean, as somebody who, you know, sort of looks to approach the court, we've seen them say, no, this is not a case that we're going to hear. Occasionally, when a case is of huge public importance
interest.
And significance, exactly, of public interest, one might say, okay, well, the constitutional dimensions are not very clear here, and yet that sort of public interest is what is determinative, I think, for the court in deciding to hear a particular matter.
It seems on the surface of it quite simple, right? But it is actually quite a intricate and difficult thing to understand. The processes by which the laws are made, by which amendments are made, and then eventually how it impacts on our day-to-day life. And I wonder, in your experience in the world of allowing people more access to this constitutionality and the protections of the Constitution, have you seen the gap in terms of accessing it because of cost? Because it is also quite a prohibitive exercise to get to the Constitutional Court, to get through any court system, actually.
There's no question. And here, you know, one has to accept that this is how inequality perpetuates itself. Mm-hmm. And that inequality has a really meaningful impact in terms of how people access their rights. So we can say the Constitution, you know, applies equally to mm-hmm. all. But when you aren't able to access the courts to make those rights enforceable, you are at a huge disadvantage. And there's no question that legal costs, as you say, are prohibitive. Do you think one of the things that we need to celebrate alongside 30 years of a constitution is the fact that the constitution has allowed for a really flourishing and diverse civil society space? And so you do have a number of organizations acting in the public interest for the public, as it were, who are willing to take on costs as pro bono. What the Constitution also has done, I mean, to be a little technical, but in terms of its standing rules, right, it has allowed, it has expanded the space in terms of which people and actors can bring cases. So you don't have to be specifically personally touched by a violation of a right to approach the court. You can be acting in the public interest. So again, it capacitates, it allows civil society organizations, and as I've said, we've got this flourishing diverse space, those actors to approach the court. But that, you know, while we have had that, and I think many of our most significant constitutional court judgments, and you think about the Navarapin ruling, right, the HIV ruling, where you have the Constitutional Court, essentially that ruling saving millions of lives, where they instruct the court, I mean, they instruct the state to make antiretrovirals available to pregnant mothers so that there is no transmission. That was brought by, you know, Treatment Action Campaign. So many of our most significant cases that have had this enormous impact on the quality of people's lives have come by civil society organizations using the Constitution. But that still is no answer to the fact that, you know, for an ordinary person, costs are prohibitive. And yes, we do have institutions like legal aid, but they are massively oversubscribed. And so that's a problem.
And people who do have a closer relationship or access, our legislators, do you think that those individuals have a deep, honest and clear understanding of what's available in the Constitution when working through new laws or amendments to laws, and therefore can argue effectively for these changes?
I think one of the things that has to be understood, and that I don't think legislatures, those, you know, parliamentarians acting in the legislature properly understand. I spoke about the Constitutional Court being the ultimate referee. It is the ultimate referee, but it's not the only referee, right? The Constitution enjoins all arms of state, whether you're at the executive level, whether you're on the bench as a judge, whether you're in parliament, to uphold, protect, and defend the Constitution. I think we hear the pronouncements from parliamentarians, and it's clear it doesn't seem that they've ever read this document, even paged through it. That's it. Often the work of devising rules is quite technical. And I don't think, you know, we should think it's a problem necessarily. So, for instance, the Palapala matter, right, that we've just heard, the courts just struck down a particular rule that Parliament enacted, and then they've also struck down the vote that was taken under that rule. You know, looking at that rule, was it designed, you know, with kind of ill intent? I don't know that one can say that clearly. Certainly it's you know, the court has found it unconstitutional, so it's unconstitutional. But you know, in terms of, you know, enacting laws, it's a technical process. Parliamentarians might not be able to envisage every situation, and it might only be in the context of specific circumstances that the unconstitutionality becomes clear, right? So I would say I'm less concerned about the laws. I mean, actually, we've had, you know, not so many laws struck down as unconstitutional, and more the political discourse that is emanating from those in Parliament. And that, I think, that language and the way in which they engage with each other seems so contemptuous often of our Constitution.
And I mean, I know that there's no wand that one can wave, but in your experience and in your opinion, how can we get more ordinary South Africans interested in the Constitution and what it promises every citizen, but also all the responsibilities that each of us as a South African then have also to uphold?
Yeah, right. And I mean, this Constitution is not going to keep itself ticking over, right? It's going to need the younger generations to use it to defend it, to expand it. And that means knowledge of the Constitution, being able to, you know, approach the courts to enforce it, but also speaking out when power is abused, when, you know, individuals are victimized. I do think that over 30 years, we have got such richness here. And I don't know why we don't have a better kind of school-based offering, not just of the Constitution and what's contained in here, because that can be pretty dry, I suppose. And, but to tell the stories about the cases, to tell the stories about the nevirapine, the antiretrovirals,
and what it means.
The judgments, but what it meant for those judges to sit there. And, you know, in that case, for instance, the court was filled with Treatment Action Campaign activists, right? Knowing that they were out, you know, they were demonstrating outside. Again, the court has always been very clear. It doesn't, you know, it's not there to respond to public pressure. But you can't not be aware of what your judgment is going to mean to those women in your court, right? Mm-hmm. For their babies, for their children. Mm-hmm. You can write those stories. I think you can imagine a play about the appointment of Justice Yvonne Mokgoro and Cato Reagan and what it means when they've never been judges, right, before stepping into this court with all the eyes of the country on it and all the eyes of the world, and what that pressure must have meant. You've got you at home with young children, and then you're sitting, you know, sort of presiding, handing down judgments that are going to have this enormous, enormous consequential effect for the lives of South Africans. I think that we need to mine that richness. Mm. We need to make it available in schools. And it needs to be there sort of as part of your everyday curriculum. Mm. And I think that that's what's going to safeguard the Constitution.
Wow. That's amazing. I think that's a fantastic place to end. That was amazing.